all animation is based on change, I think. So you're changing one thing into another, and that lasts about 5 minutes, and then you can't stand it anymore. However interesting it is, you just unplug after 5 minutes. And the other kind of animation is drawings or images, computer images, that walk and talk, which that will sustain for 100 minutes. 72 minutes if the kids have to have a pee, isn't it? That's the sort of rule. So obviously we're going to choose images that walk and talk.
Good evening, boils and ghouls. Welcome to Acme Podcast Spooktober Spectacular. I can't do the voice. Hi, how's it going, guys? What's up? I'm Kaiju Emperor. We're back. Spooky month is my favorite month of the year, and I'm joined by my co-host, Jank.
Welcome, everyone, to... I can't do the Igor voice all that well. I tried to, and I just, like, lost... I lost the Igor vibe. I lost the Stooge energy.
You gotta go, yes, master.
Yes, master. I can't do it.
And then... Or you could do, I did the good evening... I did the Dracula, but I could also go, good evening, boils and ghouls.
Oh, that's Crypt Keeper. Everyone can do the Crypt Keeper. It's like... I was about to scare... I can't... It's like, you know, uh-huh. It's like a pun. It's like... All scare and love and war!
There you go. You got there. See, you got there eventually.
Yeah, just replace words with Halloween words. I'm going to Autobone to fix my... scar! Ooh!
Why didn't the skeleton cross the road? He didn't have the guts!
You know. Etc.
John Kester must have had, like, a really good paycheck. Just do a stupid voice, a silly voice for a couple hours in the booth. Say some puns. Bam. Bajillion dollars.
You know. I wish more voice actors got paid that well. But then again,
I mean, he probably didn't get paid that much for Crypt Keeper, for being honest. But like,
probably not.
I'm sure the con appearances make up for it. I hope they do. I like the Crypt Keeper. I think he is important to the pop culture narratives.
I mean, we always make the joke about Scott McNeil. Why did you do all those Barbie movies? Scott McNeil gotta eat. But yeah, it's spooky month, so,
Can we have that in post?
I can. I need to try to make a spooky intro. I tried last year, but it just didn't... I don't know, I couldn't make it work.
I think whenever...
But I'm gonna try again.
Listen, whenever he says something scary, like, just have that Takata and Fugue, like, play... Mm-hmm. At your discretion, whenever. Just really, really scare the audience. Get them on their toes. Keep them guessing.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, this month we're going to talk about, as you can see from the episode, we're going to talk about Frankenweenie and Coraline for this one. And then for the next episode of Spooky Month, we're going to talk about Over the Garden Wall. But that's not this one.
Nope.
And before we get there, Jank, what's up? What have you been up to? Anything interesting?
Well, besides just the wonderful world that is New York baseball that I have been following because I love my New York Mets, which at the time of us recording this, are going to defeat the Dodgers in a beautiful, explosive fashion. And you can have that on my tombstone. I'm cementing myself. It's going to be awesome watching this and hearing me be right in 4 hours. But besides that, nothing really, just regular stuff. New York Comic Con rolled by in my neck of the woods. So I got...
Yeah. Did you go?
Nah, it's kind of not my thing anymore. They've kind of cemented it as the Funko Pop and exclusives convention that's not really exclusive.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of become a shell of what it is because of just different conventions sort of splintering off and doing their own thing. There's Anime NYC, which is like where all the anime stuff kind of happens. There's still a really big artist alley, and boothing there is like, you know, still fucking, it still means something because it's a Comic-Con. But mm-hmm. otherwise, it's just been following up on like news from that. Some cool things.
From what I've heard, like, if you want to go to a Comic-Con, like San Diego Comic-Con is kind of where you want to go.
Like that, yeah, that's just the one. That's just like the comic convention you want to go to. There's also, because I asked some friends who did go, and there's like, it's really all in the singles and the collector editions. There's no like, there's no trades up for sale. There's no like reissues of stuff. Sellers don't have like old trade paperbacks that they want to sell you, and it's kind of sad because we were talking about this. Me and my friends talking about this. Just how indicative it is of how hard comics flop to, again, fucking manga.
Because mm-hmm.
Trades always sell well. This is a fact. This is like a historic fact is that trade paperbacks always outsell like individual issues. But the comics are what makes the money because of all the variant covers, the exclusives, the 1 of 15s from like local store sellers, which that is how the stores make money too. Meanwhile, with manga, I can find that shit in Target now. I can read Chainsaw Man and Dandadan in fucking Target. In a month, I'm going to see Kagurabachi in Target and Walmart and ShopRite, probably. That's just crazy.
It's a similar, like, some things are just being pushed out, like, you know, this is, like, semi-related, but, like, you got stuff like Yu-Gi-Oh! The card game is kind of being pushed out of a lot of stores for, like, One Piece and Lorcana. You know, it's just kind of the shifting of markets and all that shit.
That breaks my heart a bit, but also, like, that's kind of what Yu-Gi-Oh! Deserves.
Yu-Gi-Oh! Has been bad for a long time.
I don't want to say that. I played Master Duel yesterday for the first time in a while, and I think thanks to it being Master Duel and it being like a weird third thing in terms of rulings that it's neither OCG nor TCG, but it's kind of also sort of OCG. I think the OCG is like fun because of like different ban lists and just like a more interesting meta where you can kind of play whatever. It's the TCG like here that we have, what we have banned is like just weird. It's kind of funky. Shit just doesn't like. It's like power creep is an understatement.
I don't want to live in a. Listen, Master Duel is great and all. I don't want to live in a world where I have to play around Maxi.
Too bad. I love the Maxi challenge. I always take it, and I don't care how much cards you're drawing. I will kill you before it matters. I will special summon all my fuck you extreme earth machines and my trains and blow you up with Gustav Max and then run you over with Super Dreadnought Liebe.
Oh, wait, what's that? Oh, wait, the Maxi drew me Nibiru.
I eat my cards.
Yeah.
I eat the RAM that my cards are using to run.
It's that you say that, and I'm just like, oh, wait, you let me draw 6 cards, and I drew Nibiru, who would have guessed? And then you're like, well, and then you scoop, and you walk away, and you never play again.
At least in Magic, it's like, okay, I know what I lost to, and it just sucks. It's like, the worst that Magic deck can do is, like, Rakdos Scam from Modern. And that got banned, because it was too good. And even then, that's like, oh, it's just abusing. It's abusing, like, again, more power creep. But, like, it got answered. With this, it's like, oh, hey, we're going to take away, like, a combo starter. We're going to take away, like, a searcher or a tutor. Or we're going to limit one. Okay. Still does the same things it does. It still has the end game or the boss monster. Or it goes into, like, Baron de Fleur if it's a synchro deck. Or fucking,
well,
I don't know.
Baron got banned, but yeah.
Oh, wait, that's right. It did get banned. And then it goes to the next best thing.
This is the last thing I'm going to say. We're going to move on from this because we could get into a whole conversation about this. But I want to say that Yu-Gi-Oh's biggest problem, and also its biggest strength, is the fact that it doesn't have a resource system. Because it doesn't have a resource system, you can just do 10 million things. But also, that's kind of why Yu-Gi-Oh is cool, but the game was never balanced properly around the fact that you don't have a resource system, because Kazuki Takahashi is not a card game designer. So the basic rules of Yu-Gi-Oh on it, at its core, are fundamentally broken as a card game. And there's no fixing that.
I was going to say, technically speaking, your normal summon is your resource. It's just your only resource.
Well, that and how many cards you have.
That's more of a magic thing. Nobody ever cares about how many cards are in hand unless there is either cards or none.
Yeah, but anyway.
How you been doing? Anything on your end that is not comics or card related?
You know, what's really funny was what you said about a minute ago. I'm going to see Kagura Bachi in Walmart. I've been reading Kagura Bachi.
You've been hopping on Peak. How is it?
I'm only like 10 chapters.
Okay. So you're at the start of it. What are your thoughts?
It has a lot of really nice shot composition, and the art is really nice, and it has like really good page flow. The action is actually really well choreographed. But there's nothing like super crazy yet. We'll see. I like it so far though. And it is, I would say, especially from a page and art layout perspective, very, very good. But not blowing me away just yet. You know? It reminds me of early Bleach when Taite Kubo actually had time to draw his pages. And could draw a really good page layout and not have to draw blank backgrounds all the time. Did you know that one of the reasons that Waco Mundo is in Waco Mundo is because Taite Kubo didn't have to draw a bunch of complicated backgrounds because they're in the middle of fucking nowhere?
That's crazy. I was just... You saying Bleach and mangas have reminded me, like... Do you know what's celebrating its 25th anniversary this year?
What?
Naruto. Oh no. I was trying to be like manga stuff, not turn you to dust stuff. Okay, to be fair, the manga did come out in like the literal tail end of the 99. The actual Naruto as we got was here in like 2002. So really, Naruto as we know it is like 23 years old. But it's still a while. That's still a
Yeah, celebrating the 25th anniversary of Boruto's dad.
And I saw a lot of that, like, adverts for that because of Comic-Con. There was a pop-up store in the city for just Shonen Jump stuff. There was, like, Naruto merch to celebrate. There's a fucking Kurama and Gamachi Transformer they're doing.
I saw that.
And, with one more just thing before we go back to your manga talks is that there is in the works... This was not a fucking bit. I thought it was a fake thing for fun. But a Naruto crossover comic with IW's TMNT.
You know, that feels like a thing that should have happened a long time ago.
Right?
When Naruto was at the height of its popularity, that feels like the thing that should have already happened.
You know that we're going to get that incidental scene. It's either Naruto's gonna have pizza or the turtles are gonna go to Ichiraku Ramen.
Pizza. One or the other.
Perfect. He has to meet Mikey. If they are not friends, if they're not best friends, I'm suing. I'm going to the streets. I am parading. I don't know what I'm praying for, but I need to see these two nice, happy orange boys that I love very dearly, who are also ninja. By purely by name alone, because they're the worst fucking ninjas ever. But yeah. I'm excited to see what's happening with that.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Like I said, not much to say about Kagurabachi because I'm still so early. But the other manga that I've been reading, which is something I've been meaning to read for a long time, is Witch Hat Atelier.
Ooh.
Have you read Witch Hat Atelier?
I think I read like the first 10 to 15-ish. I got to the part where we established, like, oh yeah, here's some other students that the main girl, like the other students that Oifei or whatever is teaching, and then they went to like a town, and that was like the first sort of like encounter they had with the individuals.
That's like 5 chapters.
That's 5 chapters? Damn.
Because it's a seinen, and it's a monthly, so the chapters are like twice as long.
That's true. So yeah, like yeah, I got to that first, that sort of that first kind of like arc, I guess.
Yeah, the thing that I want to say about Witch Atelier that got me to read it was I can't remember. I think it was iPad Wolf who talked about Atelier is one of those mangas. Excuse me. That plays with panel and shot composition so amazingly. And I'm going to show you a panel. You probably already saw it, but like, this is like a perfect example. Like this middle, I'm going to post this in the show notes actually of this one page of from Atelier. This middle panel right here where she's walking and then the actual panel line at the bottom becomes the stairs, and then it transitions to the middle panel of her walking up those stairs into the next panel from that panel, but they made the stairs the panel, and it transitions on the left side into the like art of the stairs, and you can actually see the fountain down there where, like, under the panel where the fountain next to these stairs would be. And Witch Hat Atelier does the stuff like this a lot, and it's fucking amazing.
I don't know. I think we still have to like find the notes. I was just like going in a circle for 2 seconds. Let me.
No. I'm putting it in here in general, but I'm talking to the people at home. Like the people at home, I'm letting them know because this is a podcast. I'll put this in the show notes.
Oh, God, like I'm just imagining seeing, like the actual Tankobon, like just that would look. That looks fucking sick. Like, the actual 3D image of it, that's pretty good.
This is just, like, one of the first examples. And this is, like, early on, and I know that it does a lot of other cool stuff like this. Beyond that, though, Witch Hat Atelier is just, like, how do I want to say this?
Comfy?
Yeah, it's comfy. It has the vibes of, like, something like, Howl's Moving Castle, or Ni No Kuni, or there's another one I'm thinking of. Freyrun is actually, it's very Freyrun. It's like very. I love when Japanese media really tries to like do things with Western fantasy, because they do it. They do things like super interestingly. You know, Dark Souls is another example of like a Japanese, like Western fantasy from a Japanese perspective.
Mm-hmm.
It's unfortunate that like there's very few examples of the other side of that. I think Avatar is kind of the only one I can think of that's good of, you know, Asian or Eastern fantasy from the perspective of like a Western perspective. Like I can't think of another good example actually. It's mostly bad. But, then the other thing was fucking Hunter x Hunter started back up again. Jesus fucking Christ, there's so much happening right now in Hunter x Hunter.
I have not checked. I should. I'm just not ready. I'm not ready for it to be gone again.
It's so good. The the Succession War arc is so fucking good. Oh man, go if listen, go read Hunter Hunter. If you haven't heard about Hunter Hunter being back again, go read it right now. Hunter Hunter is so fucking good. I'm glad it's back. This is not something I watched or read or whatever, but it's super interesting because I kind of want to mention it. Did you hear about the thing about One Piece?
It's going on hiatus both like manga wise and show wise. I heard.
No, just the anime.
Oh. Oh, I thought the manga was like, I mean, it was just going to be like a week hiatus. Like for
well, yeah,
just,
he does.
Yeah,
he does
that's
that
normal.
A lot now.
That's normal. Everyone was just going crazy about the actual anime hiatus, which.
6 months.
Like. Yeah.
Yep.
I mean, it's
actually crazy.
Has One Piece gone on hiatus like the anime before?
Nope.
Really?
Like I might have had a short break for the time skip in the anime, but I don't think it ever has. It's been weekly forever. ever since it started airing. So this is like a major deal, you know, and it makes me be like, are they going to finally turn One Piece into a seasonal? Because I think One Piece is one of the last weekly anime out there. And I don't count Pretty Cure, because, like, Pretty Cure, they have they run by year, you know? Like, they run for a year, and it's, like, it's not, like, a continuous thing. Like, there's a new one every year, you know? It's, like, different, right? So I think that this is the only one I can think of that's still running weekly. That's not like a seasonal thing, you know? They stopped in a weird spot because they stopped right after the stuff with Garp saving Kobe from the Blackbeard Pirates.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like a weird place to stop.
I mean, like, it could just be like unprecedented burnout or like unexpected burnout from some animators. Like, oh shit, we probably should like take a break because we've and just in general, because I know One Piece is like always like good. It's One Piece, but for the last like what 5-ish years, 4-ish years, it's been like really like nonstop. Like there hasn't been like a break to like what One Piece has been doing. I've kind of felt it, and I don't think it's bad. I think it's just that I'd rather they like just say, "Hey, we're gonna stop it." It crashes, and we go back to like fucking Somebody Archipelago, Fishman Island, like looking One Piece.
We're gonna reanimate it because we know that the time skip era, especially the early time skip era, is just not up to the current standards of what we have been doing recently, and we want to do it properly.
Yeah, no, like that. Yeah, that reanimate project, that reanimation like initiative, is it like it's just. Is it like just, I don't even know what it really is. It's just like redoing things to make it look like.
It's redoing entire arcs, condensing them to fix the pacing problems of like the anime that it had for a long time and has been in recent couple years been fixed, and the animation problem has also been fixed. But this really started to become a problem. The pacing and the animation problem. People really, really started to notice it during Marineford, and it just kept getting worse until we got to, like, Wano. Like, Wano was when they started to really make, like, a shift to making higher quality stuff and having a new animation director. So they're going to go back and redo a lot of that older stuff. That's just not up to what they want anymore. And then they got the new anime coming up by Studio Wit.
Yeah, like G One Piece. How come you get 2 One Piece Kais while you're still airing?
Because One Piece is the biggest manga in existence.
I know, it's just really fucking funny that like 1 6-month hiatus, and everyone's like, "Guys, is One Piece over? Is this like the end of everything?" It's like, dude, like, get real. It's like, I get it. One Piece, big thing. It can't end, but it's gonna end. We know we're in the end game.
Yeah, it's just gonna take like 7 years before we actually get there.
Hey, 7 is more than 17.
The other thing. Here's the thing about One Piece. Especially a lot of Western fans don't seem to understand about One Piece. One Piece is the third highest selling comic book of all time. And the only thing that outsells it is Batman and Superman. Not a run of Batman and Superman, not like a specific era of Batman and Superman. The entirety of Batman and Superman's existence are the only things that have outsold One Piece.
Huh.
And if One Piece's numbers continue to grow, it will eventually even outsell those. Like, I don't think any of you understand exactly how fucking massive One Piece is as a comic. It's unbelievable. We're going to be talking about One Piece forever. More people are getting on the One Piece train. Some people are calling it the modern Odyssey, etc. It's One Piece is the One Piece is real. But anyway, I just wanted to talk about that because it was like, so, like, we're an animation podcast, and that's kind of like a very super unprecedented thing in the animation. It's kind of crazy, actually. Never had this happen before. And the last thing, you know, I'm going to briefly mention it. Blue Lock Season 2 started. Started watching that. Now, here's the thing about Blue Lock Season 2. Blue Lock Season 2... I'm like, man, I'm feeling this budget. Not in the, while there's a lot of animation happening, in the exact opposite way. I'm feeling like, oh, they clearly have a limited budget for this anime. You know? Like, a lot of still shots, a lot of, like, certain things that you see a lot in, like, low-budget anime. However, it's not about your budget. It's about how you use your budget. Because they are doing a lot of super interesting things to really oomph up the limited animation that they have. Lots of dynamic shot composition, lots of interesting use of lighting, lots of interesting use of, like, visuals. And it still perfectly captures the hype of the manga. And that's kind of all it really needs to do. If you haven't watched Blue Lock, watch Blue Lock. Better yet, go read it. Blue Lock's fucking awesome. But I've talked about how awesome Blue Lock is to death. But anyway, I think that's it, really. Yeah. So, I think we are going to take a quick break.
Mm-hmm.
And when we get back, we're going to talk about Franken. See you in a minute. And we're back.
Welcome back to the 3S.
Welcome. We're going to talk about... First, we're going to talk about Frankenweenie, because I think we have less to say about it. So, Frankenweenie was a 2012 animated stop-motion film directed by Tim Burton.
Mm-hmm.
And it was actually based on a short film that he did. It was one of the first things he ever did. I think it's actually the first thing he ever did. It was like a student film. He did way back in the day. It was a short film. And they decided to eventually turn it into a feature-length film. I believe, yeah, the short film came out in 1984. And it was only half an hour. Very short.
Mm-hmm.
And while I don't think this movie is bad, I think it didn't have enough juice to make more than a short film. Juice. But just to go over the cast here, directed, like I said, directed by Tim Burton, with screenplay by John August, and it was produced by Tim Burton and Alice Abate, and it stars Catherine O'Hara, Martin Short, Martin Landau, Charlie Theron, Atticus Shafter, and Winona Ryder. It also, some people might recognize James Hiroyuki Liao in this as Toshiaki, because James Hiroyuki is probably most recently famous for being the motion capture actor and voice actor for Kenji in Ghosts of Tsushima.
Huh. Cool.
The more you know.
The more you know. My bit of voice actor trivia is, if one of the extras was Tom Kenny, I heard him.
Really? I didn't hear him. Where was he?
It was in like the PTA meeting scene where they were talking about Mr. I don't want to butcher the name, just the professor guy, the science, uh-huh. Mr. Science Man. They're like, "Hey, science is the Pluto is a planet, all right." I should.
Oh, that
know.
Was him.
Yeah, I don't know. Just like in the background. That I caught that. I was like, "Oh, cool." But otherwise, yep. Ensemble cast as always with these kinds of movies. Was this like a Disney production?
Yeah, I forgot that this was a Disney production, but I guess that makes sense because Disney production, they also did Nightmare when it was still, they were still like Touchstone as like an affiliate of Disney, mm-hmm. you know? So I guess that makes sense that it is a Disney film. It is definitely not your typical Disney film in terms of tone, though. It's very much a Burton movie in the best and worst ways, I would say. You know what I mean?
I mean, like, I watched this and I was like, this is pleasant. There was like, there was nothing like egregious about it. I guess just sort of like, I'm trying to really think here. Even just, what's it? Is there a message in the movie? I mean, there is, obviously, but it's, like, kind of not important. It feels, like, empty. Because it was, as you said, 30 minutes short, and they started trying to stretch it out. And I feel like if this was just boy brings back dog, sad, it's like, yay, my dog is back, but then, uh-oh, and then dog dies for real, and it's like, oh, well, that's one thing. But it had to be, like, the Disney style, like, oh, well, you know, it's happy endings, and also a message that science is cool. I guess.
I mean, I do like his line about people, he said that people tend to like the answers that and solutions science gives you, but they don't like asking questions.
Oh, that scene rocks. It just feels like out of place. It's like, it's good, but it feels like it's from a different movie. It feels like it's from Meet the Robinsons.
Mm.
It feels like it was taken from a different movie. Or, I don't know. I'm sure that it was like a Burton thing too, or like a screenplay thing to make things sort of line up better. And I don't hate it. It was a nice scene. I remember like a teacher I had was a science teacher who was like that very thick accent, like immigrant dude who like was really fucking smart and quite verbatim said, "Americans are stupid sometimes, but you must learn and be better American."
Mm-hmm.
And he said something like akin to that. And I thought like, wow, like, yeah, having that movie is really cool. Like that yeah. scene is a really good scene. It just feels like once that's done, it goes back to, all right, here's the monster hijinks.
Here's our pastiche of the Frankenstein novel. More pastiche of the original black and white film than the actual novel. Especially with the poodle with the Bride of Frankenstein hair and the windmill and all this stuff. The fact that they went out of the way to make this is like Tiny Holland to have to make sure that the fact that there's a flaming windmill scene makes sense is actually kind of funny.
Yeah, and New Holland and the iconic New Holland Danish girl.
Yep. Honestly, I think that's pretty funny.
what was it? When our writer's character, like, having hair that looks like, what was it? Fucking, what's her name from Beetlejuice?
Oh, Lydia?
Lydia's hair in the cartoon. I don't know if it's in the show, I think in the movie too. Like, yeah. Like that. Like, just that. Like, just a lot of homages to other horror things, which I appreciate. And some of them just a little out of left field. Like, okay. At first, I was like, okay, it's neat that they're like 50s neighborhood, they have a Japanese immigrant kid. And it's like, oh, never mind. Gamera's here now. And in any other like piece of media, I'd be like, well, fuck, that's a little too on the nose. Maybe you could be a little more like interesting about it. But then I'm thinking, like, no, it's neat that like kaiju are being put into like the horror film like veil, like,
yeah,
like umbrella.
And I mean, like at the beginning of the movie, Victor's little like film that he made, like he straight up has a Rodan toy. You know,
like that's neat. Rodan in 1958, that's a little too early, but you know what? Whatever. We don't care about that.
I think one of my favorite things about this movie, and I wish more, especially animated movies, did this. Parent characters that are like reasonable and are supportive and nice to their kids.
Yeah, no, that's another thing too. I know that they're act like Cather O'Hara and Martin Short were like kind of the front actors for this. The kid actors were like whatever, except for Winona Ryder, because it's really funny that they had her voice like a kid character. And if you didn't know it was her, you'd be like, oh, that's the kid actor. It's like, no, that's Winona Ryder. She just
sounds like that.
She just, yeah, but like the parents really kind of did shine, because they're like, when their son is like reasonably sad, they're like, you know, this dog fucking gets hit by a car, it's like, yeah, we're gonna try to console you about it. We lost a family member. And then when they see that dog is a fucking Frankenweenie, they're a little scared by that, but it's still the same dog, and it's like they help to try to find it. Like, I like that there wasn't that scene where it's like, you can't do that. You can't do that. You're grounded. It's like, son, you can't just bring back a dead anything. That's against like the rules of nature, of God. And it's, I don't know about it, but like that just feels like cool that it's like, they're not mad at him. There's something much worse of like, geez, you can't do that.
Yeah. Rightfully so, saying that, like, yo, I know that you've missed your dog, but, like, you've defied the laws of God and nature to do this. And it's like, and the dad, the only thing the dad does, of course, he is like, I'd kind of like you to play sports. But not in a, like, overbearing way. It's like, listen, I don't mind if you do the science fair, I don't mind that you have your hobbies, but just try it. Just try sports. Maybe. You might like it. Like,
and he feels guilty because
reasonable
to try in sports is, well,
I mean, yeah. Like, I was half expecting him to blame his dad for what happened to the dog, but no, it never goes that way. And I don't know, it's just nice to have, especially an animated movie. There's so many animated movies where they're just, like, really overbearing or shitty parents or shows, just, like, in general. You know, like, it's nice to have parents that are, like, reasonable and supportive, you know? I do remember watching it and being like, okay. I paused it in the middle of, like, I have to know if this Toshiaki, one of the little kids. I'm like, I have to know if he's actually played by an Asian actor, because this accent.
Yeah. No, I looked at two and I was like, okay, thank goodness.
I would have been like, if he wasn't. would have been very yikes if he was just played, if he wasn't played by like an actual Asian actor. Oh my god. Man. It is cool that they committed to having the movie in black and white, actually.
I wonder, like, were the actual physical, like, because, yeah, this,
the puppets?
This, yeah, the puppets, were they in color or were they in, like, black and white?
I believe that the puppets were in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything was made in you know, monochrome. Or they might have had, like, slight color, but film, actually, it probably was easier to, because here's the thing about filming in black and white, is it's actually really hard to, like, have a black, proper black and white look, because the way that black and white captures colors, it's not just black and white, it's like different shades of black and white depending on what color it's filming. So they probably actually did have like some color on some of these puppets, but just enough to get the color gradient and stuff right for the black and white look. But I'm not super sure. And the reason they did that was for two reasons. Number one, for the horror film Frankenstein pastiche. And number two, because the original short film was also in black and white. So, you know, there's that. I did think it was funny. Like, I didn't think they were actually going to make him named Victor Frankenstein. I was like, oh, we're going that direct. You know?
Yeah.
And then the scene with the bird, with the villagers and the torches and the windmill happened. I'm like, okay, all right, we're going really direct with this, aren't we?
I love New Holland.
I am impressed with the commitment to, like, we got to have a reason why there's a windmill here. Of course. It must take place in New Holland. Windmills are in Holland, right? Oh, man. The other thing I want to say is that I'm going to, one thing I'll give credit to this movie, you know, I think that this movie would scare me as a kid.
Yeah, it's got some like ambient unsettlingness.
Mm-hmm.
If not also, in the scary reanimated monsters, then just like, just how uncanny some of the like, just the like the way the models move around, just Tim Burton style.
But I mean, also like that fucked up cat bat creature. I think that would scare the shit out of me.
Oh, that sequence was like, no, that was a little crazy for a kid movie. Like,
mm-hmm.
Just seeing it like its fur kind of distort and then just like elongate Junji Ito style.
Mm-hmm. And the weird sea monkeys, like, there's actually some creepy imagery.
Okay, the sea monkeys are funny because that's a really funny way of doing the creature from the Black Lagoon. The fucking
also gremlins.
Yeah, a little double thing there. Like they're gremlins in like attitude, but like Black Lagoon in terms of like creature from Black Lagoon. I think it.
Yeah, they had the hamster be the mummy.
That's real. That one was like, that was a good bit. That was a good little good bit right there.
Mm-hmm.
I think double dead now.
Extra super mega dead.
Fucking obliterated.
You squish.
Your ass just got shellied.
Mm-hmm. And I think that the little Toshiaki was obviously trying to be, they were trying to make him look like Sarazawa, you know, with the pens in his coat and, wow, you know, his face structure. Was, besides the eye patch not being there, I think he's trying to be like a Sarazawa pastiche.
Real, yeah, I figured that.
Especially because there's that shot of Shelly in the electrical wires, like being like electrocuted. That's like just a straight up direct shot from the original 1952 Godzilla.
No, yeah, that was with the oxygen bomb.
Yeah. No, there's a shot where he gets like caught in a bunch of electrical wires.
It's fucking that.
Yeah, it's that scene. Yeah, it's like a straight total homage to that one scene of him being in the electrical wires. And that's cool. I liked that they were like, we're gonna do the Godzilla, but also it's also Gamera. You know, that's fun. And this is a random side note that I don't know why this just sticks in my mind, but like when they were doing the experiment on the roof with the soda bottles with the Toshiaki and the bigger kid. In any other movie, especially in any other kids movie, kid falls up, fat kid falls off the roof, haha, everybody laughs. And it's like we're moving on. No, no. He broke his fucking arm because he fell off the roof. You know? You're
trying to fly.
Like, I'm like, oh, yeah, no, that's exactly what would happen if you fall off the roof. You'd break, probably break more than your arm falling from that height, but, you know.
He's just a puppet, don't worry, he's alright.
I mean, you know how kids are, though. It's shocking how far kids can fall or jump or whatever and just be like, I'm fine, and just keep, and just not even, they don't care, they just bounce right back.
They're made of dolomite.
And then once you start getting older, and it's like every, like, oh no, I stepped slightly the wrong way and my fucking, I twisted my ankle and shattered every bone in my body. I have paper skin and glass bones. Jesus Christ. Honestly, I think the best compliment I can give this movie is like, I put it on for my kids on Halloween. You know? Like, this gets into the rotation.
Yeah.
Along with, like, Hocus Pocus and, Scary Godmother, you know. Like, you know what? You get to sit next to the kid horror slash Halloween movie, like, rotation. Because honestly, we don't get a lot of really good Halloween scary movies for kids, you know?
Yeah.
It's a pity. Not a lot of good ones. There are a lot of them, just not a lot of good ones.
I think Halloween Town's good.
Yeah, but when did Halloween Town come out?
Yeah.
I actually unironically enjoyed the live action Monster High movies, but that's because I like really dumb shit like that. They're musicals, by the way.
Sure, yeah, sure.
Jenk, I need you to know I'm not joking. Those exist.
Wait, did I not watch one with you a while back?
Did you?
It was with Claudia, and she was out. He was.
Okay, you were there for that, right? Yeah. I remember now. We were watching it with a bunch of people, so I don't remember everybody that was there to watch it.
I just know about like. There was just dumb rules with how monsters work in that movie.
I think that's about it. You have anything else to say?
Nah, just Frankenweenie was alright. It's kinda not trying to shit on it, but there's a reason why we're talking about it first, because it's kinda like,
it's fine.
It's fine. It's not bad, really. It's just fine.
Yeah. The worst thing a movie can be, I think, is mid and forgettable. But I'm actually going to remember this movie and some things about it. So, you know what? You're right. Above average.
Now we're on to
the real meat and potatoes.
The real hood classic, as they say.
The real hood classic. So the other film we're talking about is Coraline. So Coraline was a 2009 American animated stop motion, film. And it was directed by the fucking man, the myth, the legend, Henry Selick. And it was based on the 2002 novella by Neil Gaiman. And this is the first feature-length film ever produced by Leica Studios.
Put them on the fucking map!
Put them on the map. And it stars Dakota Fanning, Terry Hatcher, Jennifer Saunders, Don French, Keith David. I forgot he was in that. John Hodgman, Robert Bailey Jr., and Ian McShane. Is he the John Hodgman I'm thinking of? From Judge John Hodgman? Like the podcast? Yeah, he is. It is him. And this film, like I said, was adapted from Neil Gaiman's work. Funnily enough, Neil Gaiman, before he even finished the novel, he contacted Selleck because he was such a fan of his works on Nightmare Before Christmas and James and the Giant Peach. Gaiman and Selleck had like talked about what the movie would be and how it would work, and they originally just had like a direct one-to-one adaptation, but the one-to-one adaptation would have only been like 47 minutes. It was going to be way too short to be like a feature-length film. So they added a bunch of stuff, like Gaiman and Selleck added a bunch of stuff to the screenplay, and they added on to things that were already existing.
In the Coraline book, it's just she goes to the other side, sees what it's like, is like, oh, neat, that's fucked up and weird, and heads back. Whereas the movie, it adds like the drama stuff,
right? And like the character of YB, he didn't exist, and he was not in the book. They introduced him because Selleck and Gaiman realized that there are a lot of scenes where Coraline would have just been by herself talking to herself, and it wouldn't have worked. So they introduced YB to have, number one, someone Coraline's age that she could talk to, and number two, to like I said, not just be talking to herself like all the time, because like there are so many scenes that just like there needed to be another character there for her to like interact with, and they made him specifically for the movie. And another thing that they did when they originally made this film was what was his name? I believe, yeah, Selleck, when they were working on like the screenplay and like the pre-production, he originally met a artist by the name of Tadahiro Uesugi.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, if you look him up, you can see his art. By the way, if anyone hasn't seen Tadahiro's art, he's an amazing illustrator. I highly recommend. He has his own website.
Oh!
TadahiroYuesugi.com. He has worked on several films. He also has his own Instagram. If anyone's ever interested in looking at his work, he has amazing work. Highly recommend it. But he was one of the big, when they were doing like the pre-production, like storyboarding and like the sort of visual, like trying to get the visual language of the film, he was one of the guys that they called in. He was like the main cause of this. And his biggest like sort of contribution to the film was like the color palette. Because originally they didn't have like sort of like a color palette planned out or like exactly how they were going to do color, and so they eventually decided on the fact that whenever Coraline is in the real world, all the colors are slightly muted and are grayer and darker tones, but anytime she's in the other world, everything immediately becomes warmer and all the colors are brighter. Like, almost, like, too bright in some cases, just to, like, really show the contrast between the two worlds. Also, I believe that it was one of the first stop motion films to have like a 3D version, if I remember correctly. But I'm not sure about that. And then I think the biggest, and the reason that they went with the muted real world versus the colorful fantasy worlds, obviously they wanted to do like Wizard of Oz, you know, because that was kind of the whole why Wizard of Oz did that. I don't think it's a stretch to say that Coraline, let's even for a moment disregard the story and the characters and whatever. Purely from an animation perspective, I think Coraline is one of the greatest animated films ever made.
Like, some of that shit is just like, it's the kind of shit that you imagine. Like, when people like think of like, oh, I want to animate something like this. This is what they imagine, and they just kind of did it. And as a studio, did it on their fucking first movie.
Their first feature length film. They did a short film before this, but that was the only thing they had really done.
This is what they did with the Hollywood money.
Yeah, the Hollywood money. The big thing to take away, I think, especially because this was their first big production, was if you watch some of the behind the scenes features and stuff, you can see that a lot of the puppets and props and stuff, they didn't have like an in-house makers of certain things. So certain bits and pieces were just like stuff that they got off the shelf and just modified to fit their needs. Like a good example of, you know, those like spiky squeaky ball dog toys.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So they cut one in half. They cut a bunch of them in half, and then like, you know, if you push one of those in, it like scrunches in on itself. And what they did was that they put petals on each of the individual spikes on the little balls, and they would have it unfurl, and that's how they got some of the flowers to like open up with that. Like another example is the forest where the well is. There's like all the cherry blossoms and stuff. All the flowers, the pink flowers in the trees, are just popcorn painted pink. The snow on the mom and dad near the end of the movie, that's just glue and baking soda.
Huh.
It's not fake snow. It's just like glue and baking soda. Like, there's so much. Like, honestly, check it out. Leica actually has like a whole bunch of behind the scenes stuff on how they made this film, and it's actually crazy, all the little like things that they did. Like they like the scene in the theater with all the dogs. How they got all of those dogs to like animate was they had them on a rig under the chairs, and you would like crank this this giant gear so that all the dogs would move at the same time, but they would be making slightly different animations and slightly off time from each other instead of moving in unison. So that way it didn't like look unnatural that the dogs were like they weren't perfectly in sync with each other. But it was a way to animate an entire crowd of dogs without having to like, you know, individually go down the row of every dog and make one little slight adjustment and then take the picture and then do that all over again with like 40, 50 dog puppets. Fucking crazy. Taking all that into account, though, even disregarding how fucking amazing this movie is from the production side of things, this movie is fucking awesome. A great kids movie.
Yeah, no, like,
you know,
everything in relation to The Other Mother just like freaked the fuck out of me. I know that is the appeal for some people, but for me, I'm just like, wow, like this, just the concept of like, hey, this distorted view of one of your parents that just manifests itself and then self-actualizes as like, hey, you know what? I realize that I kind of need you to be alive in order to, like, exist. So you're going to stay here forever and just keep feeding into the fears you have about your parents forever? Yeah, cool, awesome. And it's like, wow. What a neat spin on just like, what a cool story overall. Like, a lot of stories tend to be like, oh yeah, kid runs away from home, is like, I hate my parents, and then learns to love. This one just shows, like, hey, here's what happens if you, like, actively stew in, like, and, you know, like Coraline, because, you know, we saw the opening sequence. It's like, yeah, her parents are kind of pushy. Her dad's kind of a pushover. It's like, you're ain't easy being a kid and all that. But, you know, when you have those perceptions, like, take form and then let them live on lives of their own more than you have, like, with spending time with your folk, with your parents, like, that, like, the fear of that taking over is something that is, it's real. People don't talk about it as much, but it's a real kind of fear to have. It was, like, that kind of drifting away.
Right. And also, I liked that the film, early on, really tries to show, like, how bad Coraline's thing with her parents are. But, like, as the film goes on, you slowly get, like, little snippets of, like, they're not that bad, actually. They're just busy. And then it's very, like, at first it's very black and white, and it's like, oh, I get why she would go there, and then it's like, it's still not great for her, but as the, like, film goes on, very slowly, you see this more realistic, like, side of, like, they're trying, they're just, you know, they work all the time.
Yeah.
And that's very relatable. Especially the dad. Listen, nothing is more painful than when he's probably been, like, writing for who knows how many hours, and the power flickers. I would, if that happened to me,
it's just,
I,
like,
would jump off a bridge.
Before I watched the movie, I knew this image, that sequence,
you know,
and I still saw it, I was like, oh my fucking god. Like, damn, like, imagine his fucking,
too relatable.
Like, his other side, his what it looks like.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we can see that, like, he, when he's not working, he's like, he's just kind of a goofy, nice guy. It's just he doesn't get to, you know, do a lot because he's so busy.
I wonder if this was from experience.
Can't imagine what that's like. Looks at the camera. Anyway, but yeah, the horror of this creature pretending to be your parents, but, like, a nicer version of them, and to lure you in. Like, as a kid, that's scary. As an adult, that's also fucking scary. Like, the existentialism of that horror sinks in. Like, when you're a kid, it's like, oh, it's a big scary monster lady who's gonna eat. But then, when you're an adult, the weird, like I said, existential dread of that entire concept also sinks in. It's like, oh, this is also horrifying for me, the adult, watching this film with my child.
Yeah, it kind of sucked to be those things.
It's very hard to make a movie that's scary for both kids and adults that isn't just made for adults. You know, because, like, it's easy to make a scary movie that can scare a kid and an adult, but it's, like, hard to make, like, a kid's movie that can scare an adult. You know? And the horror of it is both straightforward and also subtle at the same time. And that's super interesting. The other thing that I really like about this movie is the, how do I want to describe it? The vibe is very, there's something I'm looking for here. I don't want to say. The live action Where the Wild Things Are wishes it had these vibes.
Yeah, Yeah.
That far.
No, like, I don't want to just say, oh, this is like if like a storybook was animated, because it is. But also, like, that's exactly it. It just does such a well job, like, just it's such a good job of like one to one translating that because of just Henry Selick and Gaiman like getting together to like make this movie the way it was and then sort of expand upon it. Whereas I have no idea how the production of like the World of Wild Things movie is. I've seen that movie. I don't think it's bad.
It's fine.
I just think it's like there's something missing.
It really is. It's a modern fairy tale. That's the vibe. It captures like this very specific vibe of a modern classic of a children's book or fairy tale. And like I said, Where the Wild Things Are is a book that does that. But the movie just doesn't capture that vibe from the original book. And I can only think of a handful of books in the last, like, 10 years, like, children's books that have that vibe. You have, like I said, Where the Wild Things Are, this. I would say, like, Goodnight Moon, probably, is another one that has this vibe. It's a very specific energy that is truly hard to capture, and this is like a side tangent about children's literature. I don't think anybody realizes how hard it is to actually write a really good children's book. It's way harder than you think it is, because you can't. You want to try and like make it for kids, but you can't completely dumb it down because like you want to treat them like adults in a weird way, but also like. Can't be too crazy or dark. There's like a very, very hard balancing act to make a truly timeless children's book that children will love, and it will stick with them for the rest of their lives. You know?
Yeah.
And the thing like I said, Where the Wild Things Are is like that. Where the Wild Things Are was that book for me. Like I'm never gonna forget Where the Wild Things Are, and it always makes me sad that movie isn't better.
You know, knowing what I do about that story, I can see why you are the way you are.
it really like that was your favorite book as a kid.
That explains everything. That explains everything.
Why am I not surprised?
I don't want to put you on blast, but it's also like
go ahead.
Well, no, it's just the big monsters. You like big monsters?
I do. I love big monsters. I think people can infer that from my fucking username. You know, but yeah, we know Where the Wild Things Are. It was my favorite, like, it was her book as a kid. There were other ones that I really, really liked as a kid. That one stuck with me.
Yeah, I'm trying to think what book I liked, and it wasn't really, like, any of the good ones. It was, what, like, the bad ones. Like, some Goosebumps I liked reading, like, those stories.
Goosebumps is still good.
This is, like, because that's more of an anthology kind of thing. I'm trying to, fucking, Animorphs. Do you count that as horror, that more to sci-fi?
It's still a children's, like, YA series. I would... If it sticks with you, it sticks with you.
It's more just how crazy, like... That was a fucking war! Those kids fought, like, a fucking super war!
Animorphs is fucked up, and everyone, go read Animorphs. Animorphs is great.
I'm not exaggerating. It has, like, UC Gundam levels of, like, just how far this war goes and how fucked up it gets.
War is bad.
War is bad.
War is very bad.
That's like
bad.
A young adult. I'm trying to think of a horror thing, and the most I can come up with is, like, again,
Ghost. It doesn't have to be horror. It's like, it can just be, I mean, Where the Wild Things Are is an horror.
It's just, no, or just like, ooh, it's so like I guess, yeah, like it made an impact. Like, yeah, no, I'd say that and like, oh, fuck, I'm trying to think of what else. I'm sure there's something involving robots somewhere. I just forgot about it. It's just in the back end of my mind, waiting to like pop out of nowhere and fuck me up.
The Magic School Bus?
No.
Did you ever read The Time Traveling Treehouse?
I remember that one because I know that one got like really dark for no reason.
Sometimes. Redwall. Doy. Redwall.
I have not read Redwall.
That was the other one for me, was Redwall. I read the shit out of Redwall.
Remember we read Bridge to Terabithia, and that was cool.
Bridge to Terabithia is
that one's not scary. It's more just like somber.
It is.
It's very somber and like has a vibe. Was there an anime movie for it? I don't remember because like
live action.
Because there's live action, and that one kind of fucking ruined the vibes. Because when I read that movie, when I read that book in like middle school, I could very clearly tell these are kids in the 70s. Like these are kids from like a different era. And then the movie comes out. It's like, all right, now they're like 2000s kids, and kind of everything looks kind of shittier. The mystique and vibes of it, of a small town America, kind of get lost when everyone's listening to Green Day. I don't know how to describe it.
The mystique of small town America gets lost when everyone is listening to Green Day.
Don't make that the fucking title. That has nothing to do with any of this.
No, I mean, yeah, that's fair. I'm sure I'll come up with a title eventually. But anyway, back to Coraline.
Yeah, back to we mentioned how they got together. We mentioned like the Amish stuff. I guess just like voice acting wise, good performances overall.
Yeah, Dakota Fanning is great. But she's just kind of great in a lot of things she's in.
But just to make sure, both parents were like both sets of parents were played by the same actors, right?
Yes.
Okay,
I believe so.
Because I was gonna say like, fucking, what was her name again? Voice the like
Carrie Hatcher.
Carrie Hatcher. Fucking nailed it. Really good at
his other. Yeah, the other mother. Yeah.
Like that is going into the record books for like evil mom like voice. There's a lot of good ones, but that's up there. It's just so, like, it feels like daggers. It feels like...
Yeah. It's really funny because, like, I think the thing before this film, I think one of the things she was most famous for was she was on... I think she was on Desperate Housewives. Yeah, she was. She was on Desperate Housewives. She was also in Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. Huh. And, oh, she was in Tomorrow Never Dies.
Ah.
Wow. Wild. I totally forgot that Keith David was in this movie.
Yeah, again, like, yeah, no, Keith David rocked in this movie. It's funny.
Mm-hmm, he always does. And then, I think my favorite minor character is Bobinski. I love Mr. B.
Of course.
Fucking it's Ian McShane. I love Ian McShane. He's great.
No, I'm not saying it's that bad. It's just like yeah, that's a Joey just fucking side character freak.
The mice tell me you are in danger. But they say your name Coraline instead of Caroline. Maybe they work them too hard.
Why was he blue?
Why were all of them like a pallid? Like the two old ladies were also like kind of pallid.
So was the
mom was very pale, and the dad looked like he was about to die every 5 seconds.
That was like green gray. He was like lime.
Yeah, I think that was to further emphasize the weird, like the differences in the color palette. I knew what I was going to say about this film in terms of like its aesthetic. I think I don't remember what this came out in 2009. When did I need to look this up? When did that come out? Okay, it came out 4 years before this film. I want to see a universe where somehow this crosses over with Psychonauts.
Yeah, I could see it.
The aesthetic, yes. Is very similar. The character design, especially. I don't know how it worked, but I want it. Some other neat bits of trivia. For the production of this film, over 130 sets were built across 52 different sound stages, and that the entire Leica Studios is those studios took up 183,000 square feet, and they're the most studios ever deployed in a stop motion film ever to this day. Another fun fact. So originally, a band wrote 10 songs for the movie, but changes in the tone from a musical to a darker production meant that all but two of the songs were cut. When Coraline's the fake father sings in the piano, and then John Lindell's voice, and then the others during the end credits. Hey, Cenk, do you know what band was going to do all the music for this movie?
Hit me.
They Might Be Giants.
I have seen the range on that band, and it can be surprising. I think it would work.
However, he has the range, darling.
However, I am now just imagining a literal fucking worm with a doctor's outfit on, a little puppet show up and be like, "How's it going, Coraline? It's me, Dr. Worm," and then worms away.
I'm now seeing what I'm thinking about. I'm thinking about Courage the Cowardly Dog, because they did a song about Courage the Cowardly Dog, and now I'm thinking about that crossover.
Hmm. Hmm.
Other Muriel. And the other thing was is that when the film was initially pitched, it was actually going to be live action.
Hmm.
And when they were casting Dakota Fanning, she was cast under the assumption that it was going to be a live action film. But then they decided to do it stop motion, and they were like, "Hey, we decided to make this an anime movie instead. Do you still want to do it?" And when she saw what the Coraline, the puppet, what she was going to look like, the concept art, she was immediately like, "Yeah, I'm on board. This looks great. I'm here for this." Which I'm happy she decided to stay on, because I don't think I could picture anybody else being this character. I don't think there's anything else interesting. That's all the interesting trivia stuff that I could find. Like I said, there's on Leica's YouTube channel, you can find videos upon videos upon videos of the making of this film, all their movies, really, and talking about all the little things they did for this. So, highly recommend you go check that out. I'll probably actually link a playlist maybe in the show notes, because there's someone made a playlist of all the behind the scenes of this movie, and. I'm trying to think. I think that's it. I think that's all I have to say off the cuff.
Yeah. I mean, I liked it too. I have little things to point out, but otherwise we kinda, it's a good fucking movie. It's a Halloween movie. It is runner for the top five movies to watch during Halloween.
Yeah, for sure.
It has the vibes.
It does. Have the vibes. Very spooky. Or not, or sexy if you're into the weird spider thing that the other mother has going on. Depending on your tastes. And I'm not naming names. But we know a few people like that.
Yes, we Scooby Dooby Doo.
Oh, man. And also, hey, listen. If you're listening to this and you haven't seen Coraline, what the fuck are you doing? Go watch it right now. Like, stop, literally, I don't, you know what? Don't even finish this podcast. Stop everything that you're doing and go watch it. And then come back. I don't care.
I feel like you should put this part before we talk about Coraline. Just, like, go watch Coraline now.
We didn't really spoil too much about it, but...
I'm more just like, if you haven't seen it, why are you here? For Frank and Weenie? No, that's a lie. That's a lie.
Are you here because we're funny and cute? If so, thank you. Wink.
Wonk.
But anyway, that's Coraline. Next episode, like I said, we're going to be talking about Over the Garden Wall. For one reason is because it's spooky month, it's appropriate. Also, apparently it's celebrating its 10th anniversary this year. Now who's turning to dust?
It just came out 3 years ago. What are you talking about?
No, what do you mean? That can't be right.
It's not true.
Smash cuts to that one scene of Saving Private Ryan where he's standing over the grave and just rapidly ages. Soon you will feel it. You will feel it too. Join me in the pile of dust, Jank. Just dust in the wind. Anyway, thank you all for joining us. Don't be a jackass. We'll see you next time. Bye.
Aww.
And have a spooky October.